Well, I mean, before if there was caller ID in the early 80s and things, and not many people had it, during the Scott County sex abuse thing, I mean, we were breaking a lot of ground there, and, there were law enforcement people that were swept up in that were charged, and the thing got really ugly, and had quite a few late night, 2, 3, 4 in the morning phone calls threatening and everything else that would wake you up. But a lot of that, those phone calls stopped by the mid to late 80s because of caller ID. Mm-hmm. And so that helped. But, yeah, there was all kinds of threats, at various points. But I would always try to talk my way out of it. I tell people, I have been to, Vietnam and other countries, and I've traveled a lot, and I say one of the scariest times was when we were down doing a murder story that led us to Jackson, Mississippi. And we were there at 10 o'clock at night trying to get video of, where this person was from and everything else. And a gang came up to us of about 20 people. And I tell you, that was a bit scary. But I just took the best defense is a good offense, and I had a picture of the victim and enlisted these 20 people to help me out, and I passed out my business card to them, and I had things under control until we got in the car, and the photographer says, well, I won't repeat it on the air what he said, but anyhow, let's put it this way. He
we appreciate
was
that.
Amazed at the baloney one could shoot.
One thing that I've read all in Constantine's kind of tribute to you, and also the letter of resignation you provided Gannett when you left and retired. It's important to note to the audience here: you left to retire. It was not a restructure. It wasn't a change. It was you left on your own and what you thought was the right time. You took what was sensational stories, and crime can be considered sensational depending on what what the story is or the depth of it. But you always were very level set, your calm demeanor. You weren't, you have a very, what I call a very comfortable level set stance in all of your stories. And I've watched a lot of your stories on tcmedianow.com. How do you keep composure in these kinds of pieces? I mean, you're in a police car on a chase to Minneapolis at a high speed. How do you maintain your part when this is going on?
The heart was going fast. If you're referring to the one where we had heard a description of three guys going into a convenience store in North Minneapolis, and then we were way in South Minneapolis and really didn't give it much of a thought. We just happened to be on a story a half hour later in North Minneapolis, and it triggered this thought. Those are the three guys that were going into a different convenience store an hour ago, and one of them was said to have a gun. And so just on a lark, I told the photographer, you start rolling, we'll park outside and see what happens. Well, then they're jumping the counter, they shoot two store clerks, run out, point the gun at us, and there we are chasing them around North Minneapolis at the time. And they kept trying to get the other police there. We called 911, but it was a snowy day, so response wasn't quick because it was 6 inches of snow, and we're up and down alleys, and they finally... the police got there and nailed the three suspects who were wanted for 20 armed robberies in the north and south Minneapolis. So the police were happy. In fact, I think it was the highest civilian award they would give the police at the time. Wow. And the heart would get going. You may seem a bit, steely on the air, but inside, I tell you, it was clicking.
Well, we appreciate the professionalism because, one often critique people have of local news is it's too sensationalized, it's too tabloid-esque, and the stories, again, I and tcmedianow.com, tons of stories that you've done that I post weekly, and facts and very, very much composure, so we appreciate that. Let's take a quick break. Bernie, you have time for our last segment here?
Oh, no problem. I'll wait.
We'll take a break here on Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB AM 1220.
Glaze is serving a 10-year prison sentence in Texas for a probation sentence, and he blames his stiff sentence on the Minneapolis police and the serial murder investigation. News 11's Bernie Grace has more in this copyrighted report.
In a letter written from his Texas jail cell, Billy Glaze writes, "I wish you could find out if they still think I did the killings. My life has been nothing but hell since I left Minnesota. I did not kill no one and never will. I'm not that kind of man." Earlier this summer, Glaze was sentenced to 10 years in prison for a probation violation stemming from a rape conviction. In his letter, Glaze says, if it wasn't for the Minneapolis murder investigation, my lawyer said I would have gotten 5 years instead of 10 years. I did not kill those girls, but what I'm afraid of, them framing me, because they can't catch the right people. And he adds, if I had money, I could hire me a lawyer, but I'm poor and don't have much of an education, so I can't do much. Glaze is hoping for an early release. In his letter, he writes, these people here said you could probably help me get out of here sooner by writing the parole board in Austin, Texas. If you can help in any way, I sure would be thankful to you. I hope it's not asking too much. Even writing Judge Kincaid would probably help. It was Judge Kincaid who sentenced Glaze earlier this summer. Glaze, according to Minneapolis police officials, is one of a couple of suspects. Four investigators are still working the case.
We're still following up on a number of good leads that we've had all along, just trying to track different people down to verify circumstances and keep building a case.
Despite what Minneapolis police officials say, sources close to the investigation say Glaze is the number one suspect. And at some point, detectives say they plan to go to Texas to question him. But again, police have been unable to come up with sufficient evidence to bring any charges. In Minneapolis, Bernie Grace, News 11.
Well, and the truth be told, Billy Glaze was convicted of three first-degree murder counts in 1989.
And there was very good evidence against him, so that really didn't come as a surprise, nor did his letter, I guess, come as
no,
a surprise.
No, I was going to say,
either.
It sure sounds like the whole world's out to get him when the corner of that letter, and that was a Channel 11 exclusive. That was the year you guys went number one, probably as a result of some of the reporting that you did and other people did there.
You know, it's so funny how that all materialized, and we ended up interviewing him in a Dallas prison and everything else. He was going by a different name at the time, Jesse Settingpro. So they didn't have a great background on at the moment, and a Minneapolis police officer who became a source of mine suggested that, we go to records in Atlanta, Georgia, where he was from, and run down the name Billy Glaze and see, it's Jesse Settingpro and Billy Glaze are one of the same people, and they were doing it, but they thought maybe I could do it just as fast, and it was really kind of strange how it all happened. I just got on the phone and starting calling every Glaze in the book, and I got down to about seven or eight Glazes, and a woman answered, and it was a stepmother, and he's not Jesse Settingpro, and da 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 da, and she leveled everything. He's always used that name, and so in those days, a plane flight and whatever was, no problem. Hopped on the plane, went down, interviewed her. She told me about his troubled past. And with all of this information, and he's still sitting in a jail in Dallas with the name Jesse Settingpro, we went there and found him there and interviewed him and presented some of the lies to him. It's just one of those deals where money was not an object at that time, and you could chase the truth.
Well, and did you interview him after the conviction? Did you ever face him again?
No, never did. We put a request in, but he never wanted to talk to us after that. One of the real damaging things to him in his trial was an interview we did with him prior to, and he came out and said, I've had a problem with women, and I'll admit I beat 20 of them up, but I didn't kill any of them. And it's like, that's not really good.
No, and
that doesn't
evidence
help
on
you.
Your part.
I mean, suspected
no.
murders of at least 50 women in multiple states. Another one.
Yeah.
Here's another one that I remember very vividly because we had family that lived on the same street as this man, Donald Blum, 1999 murder of Katie Poyer. You you actually interviewed Donald Blum.
I did, and you can't say it on the air. You try to disprove everything he's saying. He was such a con artist, and you could tell that he would just lie as fast as he could talk, and we picked holes in his stories, and it was pretty clear, and the jury, of course, found it out too that he was full of baloney, but. As you're going through the, at the time, you give them a fair trial and everything else and try to, point out what is an error, what's false, what's a lie. And we did a pretty good job of that. But, I'm not the one to make the conclusion that this guy is lying. That's for a jury to decide, and they did decide he was lying through his teeth.
Well, if I remember correctly, his story changed, I think, three times between the initial investigation by the – you lived in South St. Paul at the time, correct?
He lived in Richfield.
Richfield, that's right.
Richfield.
Yep, he was from South Saint
Paul. And he got his girlfriend at the time, who I think he married her. And she told, gave an alibi, a false alibi, but later she came and said, "Nah, that was all baloney." Once he was behind bars, she was just, you know, he was a manipulator and a con man, and she was scared of him, I guess, and that's why she did what she did.
Our guest today, Bernie Grace, former Channel 11 reporter. Did you find yourself becoming better at detecting the true, you know, true and false, and what so many con artists and murderers? Or did you find yourself getting better at being able to get to the truth after 30 years?
I think so. It really has not so much to do with a story I was doing at the time, but I'll never forget, I was sitting around the dinner table with the kids, and they're only in, like, I don't know, second and fifth grade or something. And there was this really horrendous story in South Carolina. You remember where the mother drove her two kids into the water.
Yes.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and
then lied about it.
Died.
Yep.
Yeah, and lied about it. And I just made some off remark to my wife. I said, "She's guilty. Look, those are fake tears, and she's not looking at the camera," and da da da. And I, you know, it was just an offhanded remark. And of course, our daughter was in fifth grade, and somehow it came up at school. She told the teacher,
uh-oh.
My dad says she's the one that did it. And the teacher cornered me a couple of days later. "Do you know what your daughter said?"
You know,
I said, "Ooh."
It's a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
Good. You know, today they'd be tweeting, and Bernie Grace says so-and-so's guilty. It'd be a tweet.
Yeah, that's right. So,
I guess I'm curious.
Anyhow, I watched what I said at the dinner table after that.
I'm curious then. Do you find that most people, when you're doing an interview with them, tell the truth? Or is it just a very large disparity? Almost everybody lies?
Nah, it's, you know, I've covered some people that are definitely telling the truth, and thank goodness they were found out in the end to be telling the truth. One comes to mind of about a guy, and I if I can recall all the facts, but it's a quick story here, I'll tell you. He was convicted of bank robbery in western Wisconsin and Minnesota. He had, a juror decided he was the one that did it, and based on a photo lineup, which was like one of the worst lineups possible. And he said, "I didn't do it, I didn't do it." And to fight it, well, he went off to prison. And to fight it, he ended up, losing his house, his business, everything. And it turned out there was a key piece of evidence of a tattoo on his wrist, and they figured, well, he just peeled it off. It was just fake. Well, I don't know, 6 months later, there was another bank robbery, and the guy had a tattoo on his wrist, and the original guy was sitting in prison, so they knew they had the wrong guy, and they released him. But at that time, we tried to get the FBI and everybody to, you know, apologize to him. He got not a penny back. He lost his business, everything. Felt sorry for the guy because he was telling the truth from the get-go, and it was just a bad case all around, and he paid the price, and nobody ever apologized to him, and he had to start all his life all over again.
I always did wonder if people in those situations ever got any kind of compensation for the horrible things that have happened to them. But
I think it's hard to pin the blame on. I think that our country's justice system is fantastic, but there's not always a the reactive system when it goes wrong is not looked out of prison. There you go. But that 20
yeah.
years of your life that you were robbed of, even if you had monetary compensation, you can't get your beers back.
No, and reputation, everything. And he was a guy that I really thought was telling the truth, and I felt sorry for him, and all we could do is present the facts out there, and eventually the truth was found. But it took a while and cost a lot of money in the process. But there's other people who just are giving you baloney right and left, and you know it as you're doing it, and fake tears and everything else. But it's their side of the story, and then you try to disprove it later.
And you have two kids. How are you a child of a investigative reporter growing up? I mean, every time that there was probably a curfew or a missing cookie in the kitchen, it had to have been a you had to know the facts before they even were able to tell a story.
On the hunt.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know. From junior high on, I wanted to become an investigative reporter, and I know some kids, teenagers, they're not sure what they want to do. They get into college, still not sure. I felt fortunate from day one. You know, Walter Cronkite was my hero, and you know, that's what I wanted to do in life.
But I was saying, your kids could never probably get away with anything because they, you know, you're already on the case probably if they ever, you know, told you something that was not fully truthful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. They didn't get away with too much, but I was lucky. You know, they turned out pretty good. So I can't complain.
No. Do you miss it at all? I mean, right now we're in a world where you could do a lot of what you were doing, you know, from your phone right now. And a lot of the foot traffic you did could be done, you know, I'd say not easier, but maybe more effectively. You'd probably be doing more stories from one spot. Do you miss doing the reporting day to day?
Yes and no. I mean, when I hit 55, it was kind of like that was my target age. You know, let's retire at 55, which is pretty young. But I've been traveling Europe, Asia, and stuff, and doing what I wanted to do. And you know, when a big story comes once in a while, but I'll tell you, there's a lot of work in those big stories. You know, and they would throw you on a plane to go, you know, cover the Oklahoma City bombing. You were gone for 2 weeks. You worked from, you know, 5:30 in the morning until about midnight because you were doing every show possible. And, you know, and so it's a grind after a while. I mean, I was so fortunate to be able to do and see so many places on Channel 11's dime, but, you know, there's a lot of hours there. It's a lot, it's stressful too, especially like, you know, some of those big stories, the LA earthquake, they send us to, you know, Oklahoma City bombing, as they said, or overseas, wherever you were.
When is the book coming out? There's a lot of great stories here. I think would be a great book.
I know more people have said you should write a book, and, well, I'm trying to perfect my golf game at the moment.
That's not
working so well.
In the way. Yeah.
You know, compared to, getting held up in a Poland prison or in a late night, gunfire. I can understand why the 17th hole of Oakmarsh Golf Course. Or I'm sorry, were you golfing today? Can we say
we're out of Kimball. I have a place about an hour west of the Twin Cities.
Oh, great!
Do they have the 19th hole?
Yeah.
Outstanding.
That's next.
Oakmarsh. That's our advertiser. I got to separate Bernie's golf game from the golf game. If you're over 60 on the ad we're posting here. last question, Bernie. You started reporting in the days of film and developing film and reporting with a pencil and pad to the final years on blogging and tweeting. And what do you think made it easier or harder to do reporting in the internet age?
Everything's so instantaneous. I mean, nothing waits for the 5 or 6 o'clock news now, as soon as you get it. And actually, I was right there at the transition. I left 7 years ago, and it's hard to believe. I mean, we put our stories on the internet and had Care 11 News on the website, but we were not into Twitter. We were not into blogs at that time. That came within the last 7 years, about 5 years ago. So I didn't even have to do that, and I know there are some horror stories about, you know, trying to feed all the beasts there. There's several in the feed nowadays in the business. So, you know, I thought it was bad enough just getting ready for the 5, 6, 10, or the next morning, when now, you know, every minute's a deadline. And unfortunately, that does, you know, call or some mistakes start creeping into the reporting, and that's not good.
Well, right now, a lot of reporters are not only reporters, they're also photographers and online media journalists at the same time. And they're doing a lot of multitasking that, let's say, probably 80s or 90s, you were doing straight reporting, and you had someone that was shooting your video, and they were doing all the editing.
Yeah.
You're doing a lot yourself nowadays.
That was another luxury. I mean, I'm so glad that I can't imagine how bad a photographer I would have been. I have problems with just the, you know, telephone taking a picture. But so it was great to work with fantastic photographers at Channel 11, and I didn't have to do any of that, and I didn't have to do any of the editing. The editing is difficult, too.
Well, you know, and right now with, you know, iPhones or smartphones, what amazes me, and I'm a tech geek, self-admitted, but also I'm not too young to remember Betacam, SP, and U-matic machines. The video quality that can come out of a phone right now in a few minutes is just amazing for what, and the portability and the lightweight you can do compared to the cameras that many people broke their backs on carrying across the world.
Oh, I know. And it makes you think, what's coming down the pike the next 5 years?
Well, maybe Bernie, you have to come back, and you'll have to be an online journalist at some point. Maybe from the golf course. Just aggregate all the information from the golf course.
Bernie's blog from the golf course.
I think there's a market for it. I think we could try it. You can see Bernie's work on tcmedianow.com. We have a lot of, especially that Billy Glaze piece, the Galaxy Flight of 1985, and also the Scott County Commissioner Kathleen Morris. We have video from that on tcmedianow.com. Bernie, thank you for being our guest today. We'll have to have you on again.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Bernie Grace. Bernie Grace, former reporter for Care 11, 27 years. Tom, it's another day, another Saturday. We're coming gone.
I'm going home and I'm going to sleep.
Sounds like a plan. We'll be back next Saturday on Flashback Twin Cities here on KLBB AM 1220.